Welcome to the Monday Minute of the Hunt Back Country podcast. If you're new, these are shorter and more informal episodes where we answer your listener questions. Joined as usual by Steve. How are you today, man?
Doing great. Yeah, had a fun weekend with the family and hanging out, and finally got my daughter to ride a bike again this weekend. That was a big victory.
Yeah, there you go.
She's 7, which is insane. But when she was 5, she could ride a bike, no problem. And then she had a just a random incident, and that scared her. And then ever since then, dude, it was like traumatic. And getting her on a bike was pulling teeth. And finally got her going. She was so proud of herself. It was a cool little moment.
Those are fun moments when they're kind of pushing into a little bit of fear and anxiety and push past it.
That was awesome.
Well, my daughter's 15 and she still doesn't like riding bikes. It's kind of a similar story, actually. She rode and had a bad experience and she was like, kind of never again. And I pushed her a little bit, like not hard, but it's also one of those things of, if she's not interested, it's not at this point, it's not a matter of her being scared. She's just not interested. So it's like, yeah, whatever. But now she's driving, which is even more scary. So
That's
we spent some time
insane.
doing that this weekend. And yeah, that's a whole different level of anxiety for me. I don't know about her. Well, cool. Yeah, we're, as I mentioned, going to dive into listener questions. We have quite a few, some really good ones for today, and then more to get to in the future. As we always say, for you guys listening, if you have a question for us, just send an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com or also look for the link in the show description that says leave a message. And you can use your phone or whatever device you're on to actually leave an audio message that we can then play back your question and answer. So those are the two ways, two best ways to send in questions to us for future episodes. And then also just want to mention, there was a thread that came up on Rock Slide this week with some cool feedback from the podcast. And I happened to see it, I think, because someone tagged me in it. So it alerted me. But we talk a lot about feedback in terms of, hey, if you can leave a rating or review in a podcast app, whether that's like the Apple app or Spotify, all that's helpful. I was just reminded of that because there was a lot of cool feedback and comments in that Rock Slide thread this week. And that was just really neat to see. So thank you guys again just for supporting the show. It's kind of wild. We're 9 years into this thing and still going strong. And that's because your guys' feedback and support and you guys tuning in. Super cool. All right. First question, Steve. We are in bear season in at least most states here. This guy wrote in and said, I was just out scouting for a bear hunt next week. So I think he was out scouting last week. He's going hunting this week. And he said he saw a good amount of elk in the area that he was scouting. And he was curious if seeing elk and or deer is good, bad, or doesn't really factor into if an area is going to be good for bears. He said, I'm curious to hear your guys' thoughts on it, maybe on the next Monday Minute. He happened to actually send that in early this morning. I thought, well, perfect. It's bear season. We just got this question. Let's answer it. So I'm assuming in his question, he never mentioned he saw any bears. So I'm assuming he saw elk. Doesn't say he saw any bears, so I'm assuming he didn't. So what are your thoughts, Steve, on does that matter? Is it good? Is it bad? Does it matter at all for going out scouting for bears but seeing elk?
Yeah, no, I would say indifferent. I've seen, yeah, I mean, generally, there's always elk and deer around where I'm bear hunting. They're kind of in that, they're just following the green patches back up the mountain, right? And the bears are out there feeding in the green patches. And I've certainly been, staring at bears in the spotting scope or binoculars. And there's like, three or four deer 100 yards away feeding on the same hillside as the bear. Same with elk. So I wouldn't be concerned at all about it. General rule, the more I can get away from activity, I'll find more bears. But most of that's going to be human activity, right? So you need no trails, no roads, no road noise. I know there's exception to this. I'm just talking from personal experience that Yeah, you just find bears more relaxed, more, willing to be out feeding longer if they're just not hearing and seeing human activity, which obviously makes sense, but it's just sometimes that's, out west, that can be harder than you think to really get away from stuff. But that's certainly what I focus on. I would do the I don't think I've ever actually used this tool, but I think wilderness or Onyx has that wilderness tool, right? Or roadless area tool. I would certainly start there.
Yeah, that's the I think that's the one that like shades purple, like you said, on
Yeah.
roadless, like the deeper, stronger purple, the more away it is from roads.
And then, bears are tricky. If you went scouting and didn't see them, did you see a bunch of sign? See bear prints, scat? Yeah, it's you probably want to pick the best vantage point that can see the largest amount of south facing slopes possible, and sit there for a whole evening and morning, kind of minimum if you're going into new country. But you want to be able to see a lot of country, not just one or two slopes, like even that where I've been taking you bear hunting the last few times you come out, there's a massive drainage and with good looking country everywhere, but all the bears congregate on these like three slopes, on these
Yeah.
basically 3 football field sized little chunks is like where we see bears every single time. But from our truck to that point, there has been 6, 7, 8 miles of good country that like, why aren't they here?
Right.
They're always in that spot. So I've certainly seen that. I can go to another spot that's closer to home in my mind here, and it's just like this one hillside, like it just always holds bears. If it's so I would, in my experience, especially I think early in the year, I'd be looking for that spot, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one thing that came to mind for me, as you said, Steve, like obviously bears and elk and deer at this point, they need a food source, but especially elk, they're going to be typically in a larger number than a bear, maybe out on his own, And so I think the bears are just going to find smaller pockets and like can be more out on the fringes where an elk, especially if you're seeing larger groups of elk, generally they're going to need a larger area, a larger food source. And the bears may be out on the fringes from that, as you said, just these tiny little pockets, like pushing the edge between edges, whether that's snow line or edges of timber to open patches, like on steep faces that have real fresh green. So maybe it's just a matter of you were in a good area and seeing elk, but it's like going out and finding those edges, finding those pockets, finding just those little sources of like the best food, at this point in time. Yeah, there's a lot to it. And then obviously it can change through the year too. So as you get more and more snow melted off, you get later into May, pushing into June, you're getting more towards, bears cruising and just kind of changing their behavior as well. So it's a matter of timing. But for right now, in most places, it's still focusing on that fresh, like super popping food source. All right. Next one, just to touch on pretty quick. We've obviously talked a lot about the recent death hike. This guy wrote in just as a follow-up and kind of elaborate. He said, "I destroy boots and shoes and clothing in general. So I really lean into the opinions of others that are also hard on their gear, such as you guys. Did the 2024 death hike result in any additional takes on the ultra hikers, specifically the temps?" And he went on to say, "I need ankle support, but I'm curious if any or many of the death hike participants, including Steve, gave feedback on the build of the boot and any issues with blisters." So when I hear super hard on gear, that's what this guy started with, and then I hear something like ultras, those are not, I want to say not compatible, but if you're hard on a shoe like an ultra, I'm not picking on ultra the brand, but any shoe of that category, they're just they're just not going to last long, right? So I would say, first of all, if you're super hard on gear, like temper your expectations for what something like an ultra can stand up to, especially if, unlike our death hike, which was all on trail, but especially if you start taking a shoe or a mid-level quote unquote boot, that's like a trail running shoe, but boot, into more of a hunting off-trail scenario. So they can do it, they're just not going to last long. But I guess, Steve, I didn't wear ultras, I wear the topos. Elaborate a bit more on your experience.
Yeah, you can certainly. I think companies are capable of building very, I mean, plenty enough durable footwear that's still lightweight and synthetic and flexible. But generally, you're not going to find that. So yeah, these temps, I would say, early, like I've been wearing ultras on and off, just casually. I wear them as kind of around town shoes quite often for, you know. I don't know, 10 years now, maybe something like that, 8 years. And early on, I didn't have any durability issues. There was a chunk there, like 2020, 2021, where I bought a couple pairs and they literally just fell apart. Like one pair, I remember I bought right at show season. I love buying the most padded cushion ones for when we're standing on concrete at trade shows forever. Like literally a couple months into it, I like looked at the shoe one day and it was like falling apart. I'm like, jeez. So either they had a new factory that was doing really poor quality or whatever, but the temps I just got, I think it's kind of the redesigned new version of it. They are yeah, they actually look pretty good. They're using a little bit thicker kind of material for the main kind of body of the shoe, and it's good Vibram sole on them. So yeah, I would say built as well as they can be for what they are. And then yeah, if you're hunting in them, they're certainly a, you know, if they're brand new August 30th by October 10th, if you've got, you know, a couple hundred miles under you, they're gonna be looking pretty rough. And they're, you know, they're certainly a one season boot, at the most, depending on how much you're hunting. But that's actually a whole nother topic. So a note that I've been putting in for experience project on the section that we're gonna do on footwears, balancing, like tempering your expectations, exactly what you just said there, Mark, of what, how long a boot should be able to last, I think is a really interesting conversation to have. Because the characteristics that are going to make it last are all counterproductive to a boot that's going to be comfortable and, you know, perform well for you in the short term.
Often, I mean, that you can pair that with price as well, right? Like you get into the true hunting boots, you're spending often several hundred dollars or more. You get into more of the hiking category, these lighter boots, like whether that's an Ultra, a Salomon, you pair that with the fact that they're also more readily available and then have like model year changeover and then opportunities to then purchase them at discounts. So, let alone if you say retail to retail, it's like, okay, $100 to $130, right? On an Ultra, I'm guessing they're within that range compared to like 350 for hunting boot, but then also this opportunity of like, oh, if I buy the previous year Ultra, I may be able to find it on sale my size for like $70, right? And now you're into, say, Ultras do work well for you, but they just don't last long and they only get you through some summer scouting and early season hunting, but they only lasted that year. It's like, well, okay, $70, right? Like
Yeah.
essentially, unfortunately, a disposable item at that point, but
Yeah. You need to do the like when you go to the grocery store and like look at the price of something, you always want to go look at the, no, not the actual price, but the price per ounce. Like do a conversion of price per mile for shoes, right? Like that'd be a really valuable, like, all right, yeah, this makes sense. I got 1 cent a mile here. Yeah. I like that concept.
This is unrelated to his question. He didn't ask this, but just to weigh in, because I've experienced doing this and regretting it, is for me personally, I love something like the Ultras, that wide toe box, which again, I wore those Topo Athletic shoes on the death hike this year, similar, very wide toe box. But I don't, for my foot, love that when you start to get off trail and you start to get into hunting stuff necessarily, in particular with side hilling. I know that sounds obvious, but really even much uneven terrain in general, it's perfect for me to have a shoe like that with this big wide toe box for something like the death hike, because you're on your feet so much, your feet are swelling, having that room and that space is so nice. But that room to me becomes a problem when I start getting off trail because my foot is just sliding, moving too much. So just keep that in mind as well. Like for me, I would much rather go into a trail running type shoe or a light hiker, but something more with a traditional fit, something more like a Salomon for like an early season archery elk boot, or shoe, than for me an Ultra or Topo or that extra wide foot box type of fit for the same conditions, right? So it's still a trail runner or it's still a light hiker boot, but that geometry of that shape, matters to me for what I'm doing. And it's not for me a hard and fast, I want this or that. It's okay, what am I doing? Where am I going? What type of terrain? That really matters for me.
The some ultras do a really like I have an older pair of Lone Peak mids that do a really good job. Basically, you got a very snug heel in there. It really wraps around and grabs the midfoot, and then you do have some room in the toe box. And those ones I could take off trail or whatever. But then I've got the Olympus shoe, which is just really wide and sloppy. And it's it. Yeah, I wouldn't want to go side hill and just across the foothills up my front door here. And those, your feet are, you got all that sliding back and forth. You're creating friction. Like after a mile of doing that, you're gonna be like, ugh, my feet are uncomfortable.
All right, shifting from gear, we have a, it's not a tactics question, but more of a logistics question. It's actually two parts. I'm gonna read them both. It's one email from a guy, sent in two great questions. I'm gonna read them both and we'll come back and just hit the first one and then somewhat separately address the second one. He said, "Is I have a question regarding the planning of routes in the backcountry. When utilizing a map service that has terrain analysis, is there a certain slope degree range where you feel confident that you will be able to navigate up and down it safely?" And he said, "For additional clarification, I'm 32 in good shape. I will have micro spikes, and this is for a late June, or sorry, this is for a June bear hunt in Montana that may have snow up until late June." So that's one. Number two is, he said, "I also have a question regarding camp selection at higher altitudes. Are there specific features you're looking for when picking a camp spot for the night in the 8 to 10,000 foot range, such as distance from a peak or ridge, slope aspect, etc.?" So we'll get to camp spots, selection, etc. secondarily, but first, terrain analysis sounds like an e-scouting tool, and what that's saying about slope degree. And then your level of confidence of, hey, I'm maybe planning this route using this e-scouting tool. I haven't been in this country yet. It looks steep. How do I know basically if I can do it safely up and down? That type of thing. So I don't know that. I think it's really hard to put numbers on this for a lot of reasons. One, two reasons. One is a lot of times I feel like these tools, they're only looking at slope from a pretty macro level, and you're not necessarily seeing the minor changes and features that could potentially make things difficult or unsafe. That's not always the case, but it can definitely be the case, meaning you just can't rely on what the app is saying. And then when it comes to numbers, I hesitate to put numbers on things because I feel like we all honestly just suck at putting numbers on things like angles. And it's also even like people will talk about degree of slope, and that's like a percentage of grade. And then some people talk about a degree of angle, which is truly degrees of an angle. And those two get thrown around somewhat interchangeably, but they're not actually the same thing. So anyway, numbers are difficult. Apps can be difficult. But to get back to his intent of the question, Steve, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you can't, it's really hard to tell. And I've experienced this. It like Alaska is entirely different than Idaho. It's like the what the soil makeup is. We can go back to that, our the death hike we did in Alaska. Remember that, coming off day two, coming off that one slope, and you went down it, put micro spikes on, walked down it, like, oh, that was freaking steep. But then you walk like half a mile and look back, and you're like, there's no possible way a human could go up or down that. And it's like, well, we just did it, but you just looked at it like there's no freaking way. The first time I really remember thinking about this a lot was 2014. I drew a mountain goat tag in Idaho, and it's the first time I was, I was in the White Cloud Mountains, very rugged peaks, cliffs, just very, very rugged country. And I was trying to figure out different ways to access some of these spots that I wanted to go scout. And, there's just really, at the end of the day, you got to put your boots on the ground and get in there and find out. The one, and I'd say it's going to be probably a general rule, but also every state and within a state's going to be different. Just depends on the what the ground is made up of is it good compacted soil? Is it rock or whatever? Because your footing is obviously number one. If it's just the ground's falling away underneath you, that's one thing about unique about like where we did that death hike in Alaska was it was just compacted soil. It was really easy. What micro spikes just dug into that. You weren't going anywhere. In Idaho, to get that steep, it would have just been loose rock the whole way. And so the second you took one step, you would have just been sliding all the way down. But going back to that mountain goat hunt, the key that I was using it was there any trees on that slope? Any trees, any vegetation gave me a good idea. If I saw trees there, even if there was one here and 10 feet down, there's another one. That was a pretty good indicator that I could get down that slope. If it was not so steep that trees were growing, then that was like, okay, I think I can do that. But you just can't tell. When I had my Frank Church sheep tag, the one I remember telling the story, if you go back and listen to it, but the route I had to take into it on Google Earth looked like absolutely nothing. It's like, oh, I'm just going to get up on this ridge, walk the ridge all the way up to the top. It was a long, I can't remember, 7, 8 mile ridge. And just climbing, climbing, climbing. And it looked like you saw some rocks and stuff, but nothing at all intimidating, and get there in person, it was just one cliff after another. Smaller cliffs, 20 feet, 30 feet, but still cliffs. And yeah, you just can't tell. So you just got to get there in person. And for this guy on this bear hunt, certainly have, plan A, B, and C. Like, well, I'd love to walk up the head of this drainage and there's nothing in there, pop up the other side. But you get there in person and realize it's just nothing but cliffs and knife ridges. And then you got to back out and find a different way around. So to say slope angle, I think is maybe applicable to the specific country that you're in. You could kind of, once you've got boots on the ground in there and you go, all right, well, this one was a, 25 degree angle, no problem, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, for me in Idaho, I'm still using that rule of thumb. Did this last year. I went mule deer hunting with Rob that runs SNS for us. We went out for a quick 24-hour trip and kind of looking at a route. And well, I was like, I wanted to get to this one point and drop off and get around to this other point. And then sure enough, like, yeah, there's some trees going right there. We're good, and got there. And yeah, it was really freaking steep, but there was trees, and that like gave us enough, I don't know, stuff to hold on to, the type of soil that was required to grow trees, just whatever that combination makes it work.
Yeah, he said feeling confident in there, and I would just say too that that's obviously very relative, because what someone feels comfortable and confident on, another person may just think, well, that's just not possible. Not, yeah, they may say not possible, but they're just not comfortable, right? And so a lot of times it is just a matter of getting out there. And then too, just like, I also ask yourself why. I guess, because it is worth keeping in mind that while it may be like, you may think, oh, I want to get up to this glassing point or whatever, but this slope is super steep. Like, just keep in mind efficiency, right? And depend on the hunt, like preservation of energy. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't climb the steepest stuff, or that you shouldn't rule out taking a very direct line that includes a pretty steep pitch, but at the same time, just keep in mind your total objective. Like, why are you going up here? Why would you consider this route? And is there a better route for the conditions, for the con when I say conditions, I mean like environmental, but also your physical mental state. And then, yeah, just from an efficiency perspective, like, is this the smartest way to move through country and piece things together? So there's definitely a lot to consider there. I mean, and going back to conditions too, just even looking at things like if you think you're going up it, that's usually a lot easier than coming down things in a lot of ways, right? So it's like, am I going up to a glassing point and planning on backtracking out of this? Or am I going up and over and there's a clear route out? Because often, coming down something could be much more dangerous than actually going up it. And so I'm not saying, again, avoid these things, but question why you're doing it. Make sure that if you're going up something that is borderline to your comfort, confidence, skill level, if you don't have a clear route out and down and you're going to backtrack, just keep in mind that backtracking through it may be more difficult than climbing up it.
One other thing I was thinking of there is I rely on topo lines a lot, and certainly with like not necessarily like at home, but certainly when I'm there in the country, like, well, all right, where I'm standing, the topo lines are this close together, and I can't go down that. So if the topo lines over there on that area that I'm looking at are the same, it gives you a really good clue of like what that's going to be like. And it's at the end of the day, you just like the answer to like 99.9% of these things is you just got to get there. Like,
Yeah.
you just got to be there and experience it. Like, you can only do so much research at home and off, and some of it to a point that's detrimental. Like, I think just get there and do it. But yeah, I definitely use topo lines, or certainly, to follow ridges out and things like that. Those to me are probably the number one thing I'm doing in the field, and certainly even at home, to look at slopes.
So the second part of his email, again, he said, I have a question regarding camp selection at higher altitudes. Are there specific features you're looking for in picking a spot to camp for the night in the 8 to 10,000 foot range, such as distance from a peak or ridge, slope aspect, etc.? Yeah, that's the question. Obviously, it's very important to caveat. I'm assuming when he says 8 to 10,000 feet, just from the context of his question, I'm assuming that's high, right? Relative. Whereas in other areas, that may be many thousands of feet below, high on the mountain
Yeah.
or below tree line, right? So throw out, I somewhat want to caveat and say, let's throw out 8 to 10,000 feet and just, I think, talk about being at or above tree line or at least high relative to the current ridge system or mountain that you're in, essentially. So,
Yeah.
with
Top
that
quarter of the
context,
mountain. Yeah.
yeah, exactly. So, with that context, site selection, Steve.
The closest place that's protected from wind and weather, that's flat, that I can sleep. It's really simple.
Which may be 6 feet long, right? Like, this goes back to immediately when you're talking about camping in this higher elevation band. Shelter choice is going to dictate what you can get away with. Like, that's to me, that's where everything starts, right?
Yeah, you got a big giant teepee that is popular right now. That needs a freaking, basketball floor sized flat spot to pitch. Yeah, you're SOL, man. You're dropping thousands of feet back down to the bottom, unless you get really lucky and find a bench or something like that. Tent footprint is a huge thing as far as I'm concerned. That's why we do bivvy sacks and tarps, the majority of the time, because I can kick out a deer bed that was started and sleep right there on the side of the mountain. You do said, I mean, you want to be protected out of the wind. That's one downside with some of the tarps. And one of the ones I use is certainly got like an open side to it. And you don't want to be like on a ridge where, the wind comes the wrong direction. All of a sudden, that's just a sail. But Yeah, I don't really overthink it. I'm not too worried about, I mean, obviously visibility from animals would probably be my one of my concerns. I am packing up camp every day. So, if I am sleeping in an area that's questionable, you just make sure you're tearing that down before the sun's up and then it's not an issue. Yeah, really just a nice little spot out of the weather and where the wind can't get you, and that's flat.
You know, a lot of people's minds, they may be thinking of like, well, what about water? And I would say that that is important to consider, but if you're asking it now, you've asked the question too late, right? So you should be thinking through, okay, if I do climb up here, say it's 1500 feet or 2500 feet or whatever, and I potentially am going to be up there on that ridge system high overnight, like, you're answering the water question before you make that pull and before you put yourself in a situation where you might be camping up there. So don't get to the top and then think, oh, I could camp here. Here's a deer bed, but what about water? Like, you're way behind the curve. So I would just say be much more proactive with that. And there's maybe situations where you end up carrying some water up and then maybe you don't end up camping there. Maybe you find a trickle, maybe you find a water source and you carried those extra pounds of water for no reason. But it's much better to do that than it is to get to the top, realize you're going to have to camp there, and then either be without water or make a giant drop, to source water. So people talk about water and campsite selection all the time. But in a situation like this, I would just say be way more proactive in that decision. And then something you and I both do a lot, Steve, whether it's mental notes or actual waypoints, is while you're out hiking and hunting, especially because we're again like carrying camp and moving, is just making notes, whether that's a mental note or even better, an actual waypoint of, hey, this spot could work, right, for a camp. Bear season's on mine, so thinking of our bear hunt last year, like we were on a pretty tight kind of knife ridge and working our way up it. We didn't know how far we were going to go. We didn't know where we were going to end up. It's, not even close to night at that point. It was probably mid-afternoon. But we clearly like we're passing through this pretty tight spot and it's like, oh, well, there's a couple beds. We could use that to camp in if we had to. And we pushed on past that and kind of kept hunting. We ended up seeing a bear. We were looking at a bear, blah, 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 blah. It's now getting dark. Or close to dark, and we made that decision of, oh, the best thing we can do from this spot, from where we're at, isn't to push forward or to start searching. It's to go right back to those potential camp spots that we, passed earlier, right? So if you're not proactively thinking through those things, making those mental notes, or maybe dropping waypoints, you're going to miss out on some opportunities when you're, in real steep country with limited options. I mean, it was the same way on our elk hunt last fall as well. Is there was not a ton of great options for where we were, and we're, as we're going, as we're making decisions about the hunt, we're also keeping in mind of, hey, what about tonight? If we need to camp, like here's a good spot, drop a quick waypoint. So that just becomes really important when you're working in with limited options, is to essentially identify and remember every option that may exist, even if that's something you passed quite a while ago. You may need to get back to it.
Yeah, I've definitely got the habit of country, even if I don't think I'm, if I find a nice camp spot, I'm marking it. I just did that last year when I did that week of elk hunting by myself. I went into a spot and there was like 10 years prior, I had put a pin like camp spot and was like, oh, hell yeah. It was like right in front of me, like 500 yards or something like that. Yeah, just super like camp spot and water. Mark those. Whenever you can, if you think there's even the most remote chance you'll be back in that country, whether it's 4 hours later or 10 years later, man, it's worth its weight in gold there, as far as just taking the second to mark those things.
Yeah, it would be great. I say this as a tip because I haven't done it, but it is, be consistent with maybe like if you use Onyx, like the color and or icon of the waypoint for water versus camp. Because sometimes when I'm on the go, it's just a real quick like, oh, let me just drop a waypoint, current location. And so it just defaults to the red X, right? And sometimes I tell myself like, oh, I'll go in and change that later, and then never do. And then maybe you're in that country days later, weeks later, as you said, Steve, years later. It would be super nice if you had some consistency in all of your waypoints of what a camp spot or what a water location looked like, and not just a bunch of default red X's. And I've been way too guilty of not having any structure, which just creates a hodgepodge of mess that is not nearly as usable as it could be with a little bit of effort.
Yeah, I find myself certainly in the moment just marking stuff. I try to do an icon, so maybe not so much a description, but at least it's a picture of a tent or whatever. And then it's really easy to sit on your laptop and go back and edit stuff after a hunt, or maybe it's a whole year later, but you're like, oh, I'm going back into that area. So you pull up Onyx, make sure you got everything downloaded, you're good, and then just cruise through those waypoints you got in there and clean them up a little bit, make sure they're color coordinated and things like that. All the plenty of little things you can do prior to a hunt to have it go smooth.
Well, guys, thanks as always for tuning in. Again, if you have questions for us for a future episode, send an email to podcast@exomountgear.com or hit that link in the show description that says leave a message, and you can leave us an audio message. We'll be back as usual this Wednesday with a full-length episode. If you want to make sure that you do receive future episodes automatically, just hit subscribe or follow in your podcast app, and we'll talk to you soon.